Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than three quarters of Americans older than 60 have some kind of hearing loss, but just a fraction of them use technology that could help them do everything from talking on the phone to understanding an everyday conversation. And now hearing aids can do so much more. Joining us is ear, nose, and throat otolaryngologist at the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center, Dr. Oliver Adunka. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Adunka.
My pleasure.
We noted that more than three quarters of Americans older than 60 have some kind of hearing loss. Give us a thumbnail. How big of a problem is this?
It's a giant problem that we face, especially with our aging population. It's really pertinent that folks get their hearing loss managed as early as possible. Recently, even hearing loss has been tightly linked to cognitive decline. So it seems really very important to see an audiologist or see an otolaryngologist and have hearing evaluated, especially for folks 65 and older.
Are there hearing loss causes of hearing loss that can be arrested?
Certainly. So the biggest group that is probably going to hit us here soon is noise-induced hearing loss, especially with the frequent use of personal devices such as big headphones. They're all microprocessor-driven. So these days we can all turn the volume up and the sound signal still sounds very, very good. The fidelity is still very good, whereas, you know, back in the day, remember the days in the 80s where you had the little Walkman, you know, when you cranked up the volume, it just didn't sound good simply. But again, that's changed.
And because of that, we're listening to things that are too loud, but we don't realize it.
Absolutely, yes.
And people, you know, as far as hearing loss, a lot of times I remember when I was 40 and I had to get, you know, reading glasses, right? And I said, that's crazy. I can read fine. I can't tell that I can't read. But as soon as, you know, I understood the issue, as soon as I got the proper glasses, a lot of people don't realize that their hearing is going.
That is very correct, yes. And the only way to find out is a hearing test. It's one of those insidious things that sneak up on you, and all of a sudden you can't follow conversations. The first sign is usually not being able to, you know, follow conversations in a noisy environment, just as a restaurant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it kind of, there's a lot of distraction. You just,
absolutely.
Yeah. So the hearing aid issue, they're pretty amazing now. But they're also very expensive, right? These things aren't covered by insurance.
Typically, they're not, although some insurances now feature a hearing aid benefit. So it's always good to check with your insurance before seeing an audiologist.
How do hearing aids work? Does it depend on the hearing loss issue?
Yeah, we get that question a lot from patients. Can I just go to Walmart and grab one off the shelf? And unfortunately, no. They're very customized, and they have to be fit to your hearing loss each year individually. So it's always good to see an audiologist to have the hearing evaluated, and then if folks are hearing aid candidates, you know, then the hearing aids will be ordered for that particular patient and programmed accordingly.
What are the main causes of hearing loss? Are there some classics out there?
Sure.
Well, the volume, but as far as what's happening to the ear, I mean.
Yeah, so what happens in the ear, the rate-limiting step that makes us hear are a structure that's called hair cells within the inner ear. And those hair cells we're born with a finite number, and unfortunately, we cannot regenerate those cells. So, for example, noise exposure, rock concerts, mowing the lawn without protection, this will all harm those hair cells. Eventually, they will die off. And it usually happens to high tone, so hair cells that are responsible for high tone hearing, and that's where we typically lose hearing first.
What do you mean by high tone?
Higher frequencies, so female voices, for example, little kids are harder to understand than males, for example.
And how does a hearing aid help somebody with the loss of those hairs?
It's a good question. So first, the first part of this hearing loss involves the hair cells that are just amplifying sound. not just a clarity. So if the hearing loss is within a certain range, and it's usually about halfway in the audiogram, just pure amplification, which is what hearing aids do, is just amplify the noise, the level of the sound, will help that person hear and function better.
We're talking about hearing loss and hearing aids today. My guest is Dr. Oliver Adunka from the Ohio State University Wexner Medical Center. If you have a question or comment about hearing aids or hearing loss, this is the time to give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What is it the need to customize every hearing aid? Is that what makes it so expensive?
That's part of the process, yes. Yeah. So the devices themselves are not cheap, and but then of course there's a process involved that going to an audiologist, having hearing aids programmed, coming back, getting it sort of right. It takes a few visits usually, so it's a process. Unfortunately, it's not a one stop shop. And hearing aids only work if the service that goes along with them is done appropriately.
What do you mean by serve? Oh, the people who fit them and that kind of thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Yes.
2018 was a big year for hearing aid innovation. The company Signia Hearing Aids rolled out a new feature called Own Voice Processing. What does that mean?
So it basically means that every hearing aid these days is a digital hearing aid, which basically means there are little microprocessors on the devices that try to filter out noise. For example, what we mentioned previously is when you're in a restaurant, you're having a conversation with your spouse, but there are 10 conversations going on around you. So that hearing aids can try to understand what you like to hear and what you don't like to hear, and really amplify only that target signal instead of just random noise around you. So a lot of these algorithms, speech processing algorithms, are exactly targeted to that.
And so you're having a conversation with someone, it can tell that's your voice and like who likely is that you're talking to.
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Huh. Correct. Yeah.
Sensors and hearing aids are a big deal. There are sensors that can be used to track activity and detect if you've fallen. How does that work?
So basically, the hearing aid can sense which environment you're in. So let's go back to that restaurant situation. So the hearing aid can detect, oh, hold on, we're in a noisy environment, it's a cocktail party, a restaurant, and it processes the signal differently than, for example, if you have a one-on-one conversation at home with your husband.
I was take after my mom a lot in many ways, and I was always worried about my hearing. And one time I was in a very crowded place, and I felt like I was having a really hard time hearing somebody that was standing right next to me. And I went in and had my hearing checked, and they said, this was many years ago, and they said, no, actually, you just have super acute hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Can that kind of create similar problems and confuse you?
So for some folks are really sensitive to sound. We call that hyperacusis.
Okay.
And typically it involves patients who also have tinnitus, like ringing in the ears. And that's often associated with hyperacusis. So those, again, the symptom would be that a lot of patients feel overwhelmed by a lot of noise. It doesn't necessarily mean not being able to understand someone right next to it. Mm-hmm. And, recognizing that, hearing in noise is always difficult, even if you have perfect hearing. That's a very challenging situation for the brain to filter out all the random noise and to really tune into that conversation you want to hear.
Let's see. Speaking of tinnitus, John in Canal Winchester, you're on the air. Hi, John.
Hi. I've had tinnitus about 4 years now. And when I first had it, I did get my hearing checked, and it didn't seem to have any effect on it. But that was 3 or 4 years ago. Is there any hearing aid type treatment for tinnitus? Should I be getting regular checkups?
Dr. Adunka?
Yeah. So we do recommend. So it was good that you had an evaluation when it all started. We would recommend to have that repeated every few years, depending on your hearing. Really, it seems like your hearing was fine back 4 years ago. So it's probably time to go see an audiologist again or an otolaryngologist. And back to your second question is really what devices do we have? So for some folks who have tinnitus, like yourself, who have normal hearing, we can still fit a hearing aid and use them as a, what we call a masking device, where the hearing aid basically emits a certain tone and tricks the brain into masking, so not hearing that tinnitus, which is usually in the high tones. It's usually crickets or ringing. And those we usually recommend that folks try those. Also, one important thing about hearing aids in general is that it's law that patients can try and test drive a hearing aid for about 30 days. So you, for example, can go to your audiologist, get a noiser device or two, and take them home. And if they don't work for you or you don't want to spend that money, you can return them.
John, thanks for that call. I appreciate it. Another innovation in hearing aids is the integration of Alexa, Amazon's virtual assistant, into hearables. Is virtual assistants and hearing aids going to become more common? Is that a thing?
I don't know about virtual assistants in general, but I would say that assistive devices and wireless integration with our cell phones, both Android and iPhone, has been sort of the big ticket item in hearing aids in general. So I think it really improves how patients can use their devices in certain situations, together with the automated algorithm that we discussed previously to detect what environment you're in. Integration with our smartphones is absolutely critical, and I think we're hopefully able to get a younger crowd, you know, who may not have gotten a hearing aid 10 years ago, that we can have more people wear the devices.
A friend of mine who's a musician says it's really made a difference for him having that option to use with his phone. It helps him with playing music.
Absolutely, yes. And you can answer calls. And this technology is just starting. So the integration of the medical device, a hearing aid, into the consumer electronics world is really a critical step in my mind.
You know, and I see on my list here another innovation is the rechargeable hearing aids. But I thought hearing aids have been rechargeable for a long time.
Unfortunately not.
Oh.
So so rechargeable options now. A lot of hearing aids come with a base, with a charging cradle almost, you have like for your phone. So you can put that on your nightstand, and it's just much more convenient. I think overall the convenience, or the inconvenience I should say, of previous generations of hearing aids have really been a barrier. So longer battery lives, rechargeable options, not having to buy hearing aid batteries all the time. Those are all really dramatic innovations.
Well, Dr. Oliver Adunka, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate your time. Dr. Oliver Adunka, ear, nose, and throat otolaryngologist at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. U.S. News & World Report has released its best diet rankings for 2019. For the second year in a row, the Mediterranean diet ranked as the best overall diet. Nutritional epidemiologist and professor at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health at Harvard, Teresa Fung, served on the panel of experts that evaluated diets for the U.S. News & World Report. She joins us by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
What were the criteria?
The criteria, we do look at the sciences. And so one of the reasons why the Mediterranean diet came up to be top is because it has the most scientific evidence to show that it is really healthy. So we look into the data, what the scientific reports out there, as well as based on the panelists' knowledge on the details of each of the diet, and then therefore be able to tell the potential health effects.
What was the methodology for ranking diets? How does that work?
We rank them according to several categories. One is whether it actually, you know, potentially has the ability to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, diabetes, what it is potential on healthy weight, maintaining healthy weight, as well as is it difficult to adhere to the diet? Are there any potential for nutrition deficiencies or other nutrition problems that could be caused by the diet?
The Mediterranean diet is the first in the best diets category. It's kind of a perennial favorite now. It's based on what? It's based on what people eat in the Mediterranean.
It is originally based on what people eat in the Mediterranean, which is a diet that is very high in plant foods. And it is lots of vegetables because it's an area that grows very well. You know, it's a warm climate with a great agriculture with lots of fruits and vegetables. And the diet actually can be adapted to different parts of the world. And even in the U.S., we might not have the exact fruits and vegetables in the Mediterranean. And we certainly, in some parts of the country, don't have the long growing season. But we can still adhere to the principles of lots of fruits and vegetables, eat things that are not highly processed. And that is still, we can adapt it to a slightly different way, but perhaps the American style of the Mediterranean diet.
Well, especially, I mean, obviously in the West, I mean, we can get anything we want at the local grocery store.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So sometimes even seasonal issues are not that big. And even in the wintertime, we can still get some of the fruits and vegetables that's traditionally grown in warmer climates.
The second ranked diet is the DASH diet, and that was tied for first last year with the Mediterranean. What set it apart this time?
I don't. You know, if you look at the points, that's the overall score is hardly any different.
Right.
And so it depends on whether there's a little bit more data that comes out, whether the other panelists, will have a slight difference in opinion. And so it is, I would say that if you look at the top three diets, the scores is almost essentially the same. The diets themselves have, you know, is a little different in terms of what they emphasize, but they're still pretty similar. I won't, you know, be picking on too much about, oh, the DASH got knocked
the
down
DASH
to number
got
two
dissed.
This year. What happened with it? Yeah.
Well, what the DASH diet, how does it differ from the Mediterranean then?
The DASH diet is even higher fruits and vegetables than the Mediterranean diet.
Okay.
And it is for a typical person, it is recommending about 8 to 9 servings of fruits and vegetables. That is quite a bit because mm-hmm. the typical Americans eat about maybe 2 to 3 servings a day.
And it's recommended about 5, right?
That's right. The recommendation is to get at least 5.
Mm-hmm.
And so the DASH diet is really almost 3 times what people are normally eating. So it has a lot more fruits and vegetables. It is also a diet that actually says something about sodium to limit the amount of salt. The Mediterranean diet did not explicitly say something like that. However, if you eat a very, you know, plant-based diet, lots of fruits and vegetables, mm-hmm. and not a lot of processed products, then automatically the amount of salt would not be that high.
And salt, again, exactly. When you go fresh, automatically, even if you salt your food, it's much less than what the processing does to it.
Mm-hmm, that's right. It preserves more. When I say fresh, I actually would, I think, maybe a little more accurate to use the word minimally processed.
Okay.
Because that frozen vegetables is perfectly fine. It is not like, you know, right out of the refrigerator, but it's frozen vegetables is fine. And it is, the minimally processed is more like, you know, you cook it simply. It has not been preserved mm-hmm. or having a lot of additives added to it.
You know, I wanted to ask you something about the issue of portions. You know, we mm-hmm. can talk about restaurants. That's kind of a different topic. But when you talk about 5 to 6 or 7 to 9 servings mm-hmm. of anything, what do we mean by that?
Okay, generally, when it comes to vegetables, one serving is half cup cooked or 1 cup raw, because when we cook vegetables, they tend to shrink. Some uh-huh. shrink a huge amount. So that's generally what the portion is. So when it comes to fruit, a medium-sized apple would be 1 portion.
Mm-hmm. And anything else, a handful of spinach is.
A handful of spinach. Then depends. You know, we usually about half cup. Yes, there's a handful of spinach. Yes, that would be approximately that amount. Yeah.
And then what about the idea of when you say 5 to 6 or whatever it might be, fruits and vegetables, you want variety, right?
Oh, yes, that's right. That's right. It's when we say, at least 5 servings of fruits and vegetables does not mean, I have 5 apples a day and
right,
I'll be done.
Right.
No, it's not. Yeah, we want colorful vegetables, meaning, you know, that 8 servings, 9 servings, or even 5 servings, you know, come from different colors. Because, you know, the different colors, you know, represent variety, and then they will have different nutrients.
Well, where do carbs fit into the Mediterranean DASH diets?
They all have moderate amounts of carbohydrate. They are not low carbohydrate types of diet, but the types of carbohydrates are also minimally processed. And if it is grain food, of course, we encourage whole grains.
Yes. The grainy breads, yay. The white breads, nay.
Yeah, I know. That's right. Exactly.
Yeah. The third best diet was a flexitarian diet, and it sounds like something in a comedy show. But what is flexitarian? Is that what I do? Just whatever. I try to do the best I can?
it is also a plant-based diet.
Uh-huh.
And there isn't anything that, you know, you're not allowed to eat, just like, you know, the DASH diet and the Mediterranean diet. But what it is that it try to be more flexible and not so worried about, I have to eat this much, that much, but it also, you know, pay attention to your hunger and satiety signals as well.
The new diet, for one thing, how do you feel about talking about diets anyway?
To general people and to people who ask me about diets, I will usually ask them to think about, well, is there something that's, you know, not make drastic changes to the diet, but is there one or two things that they think that they can improve and it's feasible? And when it comes to diet, I'm not, you know, I usually don't focus on how much they're eating unless it is the quantities is unreasonable. But I look at the quality of the diet. What are they eating? And is there something that about a food choice that they can improve on? And really follow your own hunger and satiety signals. You know, pay attention to you know, our stomach telling us that, you know what, I'm not hungry anymore. You know, perhaps I should stop.
And then the idea that you're dieting to lose weight. The dietitians, and I'm sure you're like, that's the idea that you can't, sure, you want to lose weight, but you also got to find a diet that you're going to live with.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Because weight is lifelong. And weight change corresponds to lifestyle change. And so if somebody, you know, get on a diet, they lost some weight, and if they don't follow the diet anymore, then they're going to gain back the weight.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, when it comes to weight maintenance and healthy weight, it is a lifelong thing. And so whatever food pattern that they choose to eat has to be able to stick to it for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. That's the main thing trying to figure out what kind of diet. What about diet? It's the nutritional piece. What are the worrisome diets out there, in your opinion?
In my opinion, is things that ask for extreme quantities, very high amounts of certain things, or eliminating certain things altogether, especially eliminating large groups of food. Because food groups generally are there for a reason. They provide certain nutrients that is really features of that food groups and difficult to get from other food groups. So diets that are extreme, very far from what we normally eat, then that would be a warning sign.
As far as sticking to a diet and making it work for you, what do you suggest? I mean, to people making that lifestyle change, you're saying make acknowledge that it is a lifestyle change.
Yeah, that's right. So to help make it a lifestyle change, do things that are not so drastic. for most people. You know, gradually, maybe today, from now on, you know, every, you know, if, like, for example, if I don't eat a lot of fruit, then I might say, okay, so 3 times a week, maybe I will eat an extra piece of fruit. And so it is easy to achieve. And something that you can build on, well, I'm only adding 1 piece of fruit, then maybe after a few weeks I got a hang of it, then I'll say, well, maybe then I will add more vegetables to my dinner, and a little bit at a time. Then they slowly get used to it, and it becomes a habit, something that people don't have to think. It's automatic only that they would do it. Then it's a lot easier to stick to for the long haul.
What about prescriptive meal plans, those kind of diet
plans?
That's right. They're expensive, for one thing, but what about them?
They are expensive. If the meal plans are generally healthy, using all sorts of foods in reasonable proportions, mm-hmm. and a lot of them are basically the portion size is controlled. And so that has the advantage of people don't have to think about how much I'm going to eat, and a lot of times they have food delivery, and everything is make it, you know, a lot more convenient.
Mm-hmm.
So they do have the advantage in terms of showing people, oh, this is what a reasonable portion size is, and to kickstart, you know, a healthy change of habit. For some people, it is convenient and help them, you know, they don't have to think, you know, worry so much about, you know, how much I'm going to eat, what I'm going to eat, how. So those meal plans do have the advantage. Eventually, they can probably add more flexibility to their diet by doing it themselves.
Cooking themselves.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Exactly. And once they get a hang of the portion size, then they can eyeball things, and then, you know, they can create their own meals.
You know, eating out a lot is a big problem when it comes to portion control, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. We don't get to proportion, you know, how much is on the plate. And sometimes the portion size are also very large.
Yeah.
And so what I do is usually when, you know, when I order food from restaurants, I don't worry so much about portion size, because when the plate comes, well, I can choose to decide how much I want to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would take a look at the plate and say, well, you know what? What is reasonable? And I kind of eyeball it and make an estimate. And sometimes I'll just cut, you know, my piece of chicken and say, okay, I'll eat this part because that's reasonable. And I'll pack the rest home.
Mm-hmm. Or share.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, I get 2 meals out of 1. You know, how much better is that?
Exactly. Jillian Michaels, the personal trainer who's known for hosting the Biggest Loser television show, made headlines recently when she said that the keto diet is a bad plan for a million reasons. I don't know much about the keto diet. What is it, and why so much controversy?
It is a very low carbohydrate diet and a very high fat diet. So the premise supposedly is that it has very low carbohydrate, and it is, you know, it's using fat and then somehow drives the body to use the fat stored in the body. And so if you're using the fat stored in the body, then we are definitely not gaining weight and potentially losing weight as well. The diet is also pretty restrictive because most carbohydrates are cut off. A lot of fruits are high in carbohydrate, and those are cut off as well.
And those are good carbs.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And you end up, and how much fat can a person eat, and where are the fats coming from, you know, in our diet? So you ended up having a lot of animal foods, a lot of saturated fat, and that can, then those things can have its own health ramification as well. So the whole diet is that the keto type of diet, they are very low in certain nutrients and very high in certain dietary components that at high levels would not be healthy.
Yeah, they're not sustainable, right?
That's right. I also wonder how long people can stay on that diet and still be able to stick to it.
And the combination of diet and exercise, I know you're a nutritionist, but how many times do you have to bite your lip and just say, get out and, you know,
walk? They go together. Mm-hmm. They really go together. Exercise is wonderful. And the two, I would say, diet and exercise together, it's really have that synergistic effect. It's almost like 1 + 1 = 4
mm-hmm.
in that situation. So, you know, I think that just going on a diet, you can gain something out of it. Just doing exercise, yes, you can gain something out of it. But if you put two together, well, it's wonderful.
Professor Teresa Fung, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Teresa Fung is a nutritional epidemiologist and professor at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health in Harvard. She served on a panel of experts that evaluated diets for the U.S. News & World Report. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. We have a little bit more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is true that standing burns more calories than sitting or lying down. But for those among us who have resolved to stand more throughout the day, the change might not make that big of a difference. Columnist Gretchen Reynolds recently wrote about that and more for her New York Times wellness blog. She joins us by phone. Welcome back.
Thanks very much for having me.
So, as I just mentioned, you wrote about a study that found the benefits of standing compared to sitting aren't that significant, and I thought it was a really big deal. So what's going on?
Well, let's be honest. There's a lot of interest around standing up and whether you should have a standing desk and whether you need to get out of your chair more. And there are lots of really good health reasons to do that. But most of us are interested in whether it'll help us lose weight. That seems to be a fact, that a lot of people are interested in standing up more in hopes that it will very painlessly help them burn more calories than if they sit. And there have been studies suggesting that the difference in calorie burn between sitting and standing might be substantial. But those studies were really artificial in that they usually had people sit completely still. They couldn't fidget. They couldn't do anything. They had to sit completely still for hours. And then when they stood up, they often were not just standing. They were sort of walking around, doing chores, strolling around the office. And so the spread between sitting and standing in those studies was quite broad. You were burning a lot more calories when you stood up. But that's not how people actually sit and stand for the most part.
And the benefits of standing aren't just about calories, right?
No, but the issue is, again, a lot of people are doing
that's why they're doing
they
it.
Want to lose weight. There are studies that show that sitting is associated with a greater incidence of obesity. And so the study that I wrote about decided to look at sort of real life sitting, standing, and also lying down and see what the difference in the caloric burn was when people sort of sat naturally, meaning they either fidgeted or they didn't. Mm-hmm. And then they stood up, but they didn't walk around. They just stood in place. They could fidget, they could sort of move around, but stay in the same place as if they were at a standing desk. And they used, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
They used very sophisticated techniques to really measure how many calories they were burning over the course of a day when they did all of those, either sitting, standing, or lying down. And there were differences in how many calories they burned. They burned a few more calories when they sat than when they were just lying down, mm-hmm. and they burned about 12% more calories when they were standing up than sitting down. But that's not really meaningful. It may sound like it might help. Mm-hmm. It turned out to be the equivalent of about 9 calories an hour more if you stood up.
Which,
that's nothing. Nothing.
That's just nothing. So the benefits to standing, very irrelevant when it comes to calories, but it's good for my lower back.
It, it's good for a lot of other health issues, including it does seem to change. Your muscles contract more in your legs. They mm-hmm. produce more of substances that are involved in reducing cholesterol. They will use more of the blood sugar. For all kinds of health reasons, it's a good idea to stand up. It's probably not going to help you lose weight. It's certainly not going to help you lose weight. 9 calories an hour is not going to make you thin. It is possible that it might, over a really long period of time, help you to avoid gaining weight. But again, if you got a standing desk for Christmas and think it's going to make you skinny, it probably won't. Will it make you healthier? Yes, it will.
All right. Well, I'll take that.
I would too, but if we're honest, for a lot of people, the main rationale is hope that it will somehow aid in weight loss. Mm. And that's probably not going to happen.
Okay. Urine fitness. You wrote about the urine fitness and how the most exciting exercise research in 2018 was small. tell us about what you mean by that.
What I mean is it was a really interesting year, I thought, in terms of studies looking at the molecular effects of exercise. And one of the things that I found really interesting in writing about exercise is learning how little we really understand about how exercise makes you healthier. We know that it does. We know that it affects your heart. It affects every muscle. It affects all of your cells. But how it does that, how the body even knows it's exercising, has remained really mysterious. And so one of the things that I found so interesting this year was that they are starting to find how exercise at a molecular, cellular level changes everything in your body. Your RNA works differently. You send out these little vesicles, which are like little bubbles that your cells spit out, and they contain all kinds of biological material. The kinds of vesicles that your cells produce are completely different when you exercise and if you are an exerciser and if you aren't. Everything in your body seems to work differently if you work out or if you don't.
You said the word differently. You didn't say better.
We assume it's better. That's what's so interesting in this is scientists are trying to determine how exercise does even things like make your heart work better. What are all the steps? And right now, what they are finding, and they're using tools that weren't available even a few years ago, genetic tools, all kinds of electron microscopy tools, to just see the steps. And we're trying to see how we go from taking a walk to being thinner, healthier, having less risk for diabetes. And so we're assuming that every one of these steps leads to better health. Right now, they're just trying to really tie down what are the steps. And that's, I mean, it's important for a number of different reasons. One, it's possible that some of this might lead to the so-called exercise pill that would help people to get some of the benefits of exercise without exercising. It also undercuts the whole idea of the exercise pill because it shows there's not just one step involved. There are 200, 2,000 steps involved. And taking that one literal step initiates all of them and can lead to what really are profound improvements in health.
And not just metabolical, but emotional too, right?
Oh, yes. There are clear links between exercise and improved mental health. And there seem to be physiological reasons that occurs. There was some interesting research done this year in potentially how you change the release of certain substances from the muscle that can potentially be involved in the development of depression. So it looks like exercise at a biochemical level can improve mental health. It also just at a very simple psychological level is strongly associated with happiness, with contentment, with less anxiety. And it's interesting that scientists are looking both at whether that happens and now how it happens.
You know, a lot of the research you mentioned in your article focused on aerobic exercise. What do you make of that?
Well, for one thing, more people do it. That's just a fact. But there also is some really good emerging evidence that strength training, resistance training, is not only important, it has very unique effects on the body. And some of them mimic what we think only aerobic exercise can do. Mm-hmm. There was an interesting study showing it was a big epidemiological study, meaning it wasn't an experiment, but it did find very strong links between doing some amount of strength training, even once a week, even an hour over the course of a week, and a dramatically lower risk of heart disease. And that was even if people did not do aerobic exercise. So it does look like you can get a lot of benefits from doing strength training, but almost certainly you will get even more and synergistic effects by doing both.
You're excited about this idea that they're looking at this at a molecular level.
I find it really interesting because, for one thing, I hope that it can motivate people. I mean, it's motivating me to think about all the things that are going on under the skin every time I go for a walk, that it's jump-starting just a gazillion of biochemical, genetic, other processes that won't happen if I don't go for that walk. And it's so simple, but the effects seem to be so systemic that it affects so much in your body. And to me, just knowing that if I don't get up and go for a walk, I'm not starting any of those processes is really motivating. It affects your brain, it affects your heart, it affects the muscles, it just affects everything. And there's no evidence that it has to be super strenuous, prolonged exercise. A lot of these studies, which were often done, some of them in mice, some in people, were looking at people and or animals that basically were going for a long walk. And it changed everything.
You know, speaking of your brain, you also wrote about a study that found exercise can help keep our memory sharp. Tell us about that.
It was another really interesting molecular study.
Uh-huh.
It was looking at the effects of a hormone called irisin. It's named for the god, a messenger god in Greek mythology, Iris. And it's produced by muscles when you exercise. It leaves the muscles, goes to other parts of the body, and jumpstarts all kinds of metabolic processes. They know that it helps to make white fat beige, start to become brown. And now they were looking at whether it is found in the brain and whether it might have any connection to dementia. Mm. And dementia is partially a metabolic problem in the brain. There are lots of causes, but it's partly that the cells in the brain don't use energy very well if you have dementia. And so they found that in human brains, they found that there was irisin in human brains of people who had passed away, but there was very little irisin if they had passed away with dementia. They also found that if they bred rats that were, or mice that were basically bred to develop dementia, they could reduce the effects if they bathed their brains with irisin. And they also found that if certain animals, swam, did an exercise program, they effectively gave them Alzheimer's disease, that the effects were much less if they had been swimming and had been producing a lot of irisin.
How were these kind of improvements sustainable?
Presumably, again, the most of these studies are fairly short term, and frankly, they're looking at the brains of the mice, so they only live for a certain period of time.
Okay.
But yes, they were substantial. That's the thing; they were not just very subtle changes. At least in the mice, they actually could continue to learn and remember, which otherwise, if they were given essentially a drug that causes Alzheimer's disease in mice, if they didn't have the irisin, which they got from exercise, they couldn't remember anything.
Now, this is making me think about the incidence of Alzheimer's and dementia in our society, the growing incidence of it. I know we have a lot more older people, and statistically there's going to be a proportional increase, but be that as it may, and our sedentary lifestyle in the Western world.
Well, there are very, very clear epidemiological links to being physically active in middle age and younger and having a reduced risk for developing Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. So whether being sedentary is contributing to an increase, we don't know. No one does know that.
Right.
But there do seem to be links with being more physically active and having less risk of developing Alzheimer's. And there are some fairly small studies showing that when people have developed Alzheimer's disease, if they can still exercise, especially if they can still go for a walk, the disease does seem to progress more slowly. And that's not, it's not a cure, it's not stopping the disease at all, but it does seem to reduce the speed at which it progresses. And it's, if it's possible for someone to walk, it does seem to improve, you know, all these parameters of health, but especially just the ability to remember.
Something that we should not take for granted ever.
No, not at all.
I really appreciate your time, Gretchen Reynolds. Thanks for joining us. This is a lot of food for thought as we as I get up from my desk in my studio and move through my day.
Yes, I'm walking around my office right now.
Well, thanks for taking the time to join us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's Gretchen Reynolds. She is a regular on the program. She's a columnist for the New York Times Well blog. We talk about physical fitness with her. Thanks so much to the All Sides staff, producer Mary Lee Williams, assistant producer Kyle McKinnon, our All Sides interns, Ray Brewster, Maisie Glockner, and Sophie Warner, with video production by Rich Blue and Amber Blue. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks so much for joining us today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.